My name is Brother Clarence Moses Eel. I was sentenced to 48 years. I served 28 years and 5 months.
Hi, this is Brooke, and I'm here with DeMarco, and you're listening to Actual Innocence. We are a podcast bringing awareness to wrongful conviction issues and other issues in the justice system. How are you doing this week, DeMarco?
I'm doing pretty good. I have no complaints. I want to thank Mara. Mara's the young lady who reached out to me and was able to help me get my teeth cleaned. She assisted me. I did get my teeth cleaned. So thank you, Mara. And I'm smiling. Regardless of whatever else I'm doing, I'm smiling.
Good for you. Good. Thank you, Mara. That was so nice of you.
That was.
So I have some trivia questions today, but...
Oh, I love trivia.
Me too. Before we continue on to trivia, we're going to hear from our first sponsor. Just a reminder that supporting our sponsors helps to support the show. If you can't financially support a sponsor, it's still so helpful to give them a shout out on social media and thank them for sponsoring our show. DeMarco, do you know who our sponsors are this week?
Yes, Colts, a new podcast, Away Luggage and SeatGeek.
I love Away Luggage, but we're actually going to start with our first sponsor, Colts. If you like Actual Innocence, or Convicted, or Cold Case Files, you're probably like me, a lover of true crime podcasts. Have you ever thought about cults as part of the true crime genre? I mean, think about it. Murder, mystery, manipulation. True crime is associated with all those things. But what really goes on inside of a cult and why? What drives a person psychologically to join or start and lead a cult? If you're as interested as I am, let me recommend a new podcast, Cults. Cults answers all of these questions and more. What did you think of cults, DeMarco?
I think cults are messed up, but it helps me understand the profile of cult leaders and why people may be persuaded or manipulated into joining a cult. And also, the host played real audio tapes and shared evidence from actual cult leaders and members.
Yeah, I like when they brought up the facts that weren't widely known. I think our listeners should check out the Manson family episode and the one about Heaven's Gate. I can't wait until Tuesday when a new episode comes out.
I heard there's one coming out about the People's Temple.
I need to finish listening, and you can listen to Cults too for free. Just visit Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and search for Cults. Again, that's Cults, C-U-L-T-S, or visit parcast.com/cults to start listening now. That's Parcast, parcast.com/cults to listen now. Okay, DeMarco, are you ready for this week's trivia questions?
Yes, let's hear it.
I based this week's questions on DNA since it was such a big part of Clarence Moses Eel's case. So, the first question is multiple choice, and it is, what year was DNA first used in a courtroom? A is 1980, B is 1987, C is 1990, and D is 1997.
I have conflicting answers. The reason I said that is because I know what you gave me, but I read somewhere, and for some reason I had 1986. This is just my opinion. In 1986, when police in England asked a molecular biologist, Alex Jeffries, who had begun investigating the use of DNA for forensics to use DNA to verify the confessions of a 70-year-old boy in a rape murder in English and... But you don't have 1986, and I read this somewhere.
You're right. To be honest, the study that I used was from the United States, so I didn't realize it had been used in England before that. But the first time it was used in the United States was 1987, so that makes total sense that in 86 it would have been used in the UK, and in 87 it would have been used here.
Okay.
Did you know almost half of our listeners come from the UK?
No, I did not know that.
It's interesting that you were able to put that out there, a fact that they were the first ones in 86 before America to use it in a court case.
Yeah, because you didn't say the United States, you just said in court.
I did, you're right. So I have a second question for you. And the second question is, how many exonerations have there been in the United States since 1993 because of DNA? Not counting the other exonerations for other kinds of false science.
Man, it's I'm a go with, this might be ludicrous, but I'm gonna say 430.
You're really close. 317 people have been exonerated on DNA since 1993. And sometimes I wonder, is that something to be happy about because they're free, or angry about because they got wrongfully convicted in the first place? I mean, I think it's bittersweet.
Yeah, it is bittersweet.
We interviewed a man named Clarence Moses L, and he was convicted and spent, was it 28 years in prison? And I just wonder...
28, yes.
Yeah. How did you meet him? Like, how were you able to contact him and ask him to be on the show?
I met Clarence in San Diego when I met you, and I kept in touch with a lot of the exonerees. So his numbers was one of the ones that I kept and I'm in touch with on a regular basis. And I knew he was going through some. He's been out less than 2 years, and I want him to have something to look forward to. I felt like him being on here to tell his story, I thought that would help him, you know, and I'm glad that he did.
Yeah, and I think that helps people to heal when they feel like in control of their own narrative and their own story. And rather than us telling it for him, he got to use his words to explain it.
I was born in Philadelphia. I was raised in Baltimore in the slums. I came from the hardcore ghettos of Baltimore. Mother on welfare, 8 siblings. So that's what my life had looked like in the past.
You had a big family.
Where were you, like, in the birth order of the 8 siblings?
I'm the second oldest. Right now, I'm the oldest. I'm the oldest because my sister, who was the oldest, she died while I was in prison. So I'm the oldest now in the family. But it's only four siblings left out of the 8 now. 4 of them died while I was incarcerated. My mother died while I was incarcerated. My father is dead. All of them died while I was incarcerated. So that's really, I kind of didn't come. I came out to a family, but a family no longer a complete family from what I remember when I left.
Missing pieces.
But these are phases of life. So I wasn't present, but life never told me that, hey, Mo, if you don't be present, don't worry about it. We'll wait here for you. See, life don't operate like that. What I missed is gone.
If I did my math right, that means that it was like the late 80s when you were convicted. Is that right?
Yeah, I was arrested in 1987. I was convicted in 1988, the following year.
Can you tell us anything about the crime that you were convicted of?
I was convicted of a sexual assault, and burglary, which was all one episode. I'm only going by what investigators and people who was involved in looking into the case after my arrest. Later on, years, you know, certain things turned up because I never knew from the very beginning that the reason why this woman was accusing me was based on a dream. That came out later to me. I didn't know nothing. So I can't really speak about that statement other than it was divulged to me. It came up through somebody's paperwork. Somebody went out and examined her or they questioned her or they looked into some of the comments or statements that she had made earlier, opposed to comments and statements that came late on that showed a contradiction. So, yes, the statement came up about a dream. Did she actually have a dream? I couldn't tell you, but that came up.
Do you remember when the police came and confronted you the first time about it?
Yeah, the first time they confronted me, they arrested me. And that was that. The day I was arrested, I had my son with me. They arrested me. It was August the 19th. I was arrested on August the 19th. After my arrest, I never seen society again until December the 22nd, 2015. Well, I was found not guilty in November the 14th of last year. I think my lawyer told me they notified, I guess, the National Exoneree Foundation or what. Anyway, some people that determines after you've been found not guilty, your innocence have been defended and proven. Then they go through the process of putting you on a national board or something, a wall. They put your name on it. That happened in, I think it was January this year.
How old were you?
I was 33. Yeah, I was 33 when I was arrested. I'm 61, getting ready to turn 62 now.
Okay.
I did 28 years and 5 months. My son was 3 years old when he was on the bicycle with me that day I got arrested. He was 3 years old.
So you and your son were on a bicycle. You know, he's a toddler. What was, like, did the police just pull up next to you on your bicycle? How did that work? Like, what was the arrest like?
The arrest was the police pulled up behind me and they said, you on the bicycle, pull to the side. And the reason why I didn't pull to the side, because I was on the bicycle, but I had my son. So the language that I heard behind me indicated that the speaker was talking to somebody that appeared to be riding a bicycle by themselves. So that was the reason why I didn't turn around. But when the officer in the car, the patrol car, said the second time, you on a bicycle with the little kid, pulled to the side. That's when I knew they was talking about me. So I pulled to the side. And the officer, I asked him, I said, am I under arrest? He said, no, you're not under arrest. He said, you're just being detained right now. So I said, okay. But like any other individual, you know, we had this thing where we become curious. And being curious, we ask questions again and again and again. So I asked him, I said, well, what's all this about? He said, well, we'll let you know. And so another police car ended up pulling up. And when that police car pulled up, the officer never said anything in words verbally. He nodded his head to the officer who had stopped me. And when he nodded his head, that's when the officer who stopped me pulled out his handcuff and said, you're under arrest. And he told me at that time what I was under arrest for. But he never gave me no Miranda warning or nothing. None of that ever happened. He just arrested me and said, you're under arrest for sexual assault and burglary. They said, we taking you downtown because so-and-so, a detective who was investigating the case at the time, wanted to see me upon my arrest, but that never transpired either. So that's, there you have it for that particular time dealing with my arrest.
How long were you in the county jail?
I stayed in the county jail from August of 1987 to March of 1989. And I was there for a number of reasons. Like I said, some of the reasons, well, the majority of the reason why I was still there was because even after being found guilty, you know, you could, down in the district court, it's a Rule 33. A Rule 33 meaning that you asking the court to grant you a new trial while you are still down in the district court before you are sentenced and sent off to DOC to start your time. So I petitioned and filed for a new trial under Rule 33, although that was the ultimately denied. But there was a number of things that occurred that became the cause of why I was in the Denver County Jail for such a long period of time.
How long did your trial last?
My trial only lasted 2.5 days.
Now, that's not long. That's 2 days?
2.5 days. The first day was just talking about the case and all that. Mm-hmm. The second day was actually the trial. The third day, man, they was back with a guilty verdict.
What evidence did they have? They used it. Two and a half days.
They was using the victim's testimony. They used her testimony to convict me because she kept saying, it's him, it's him, it's him. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that they had already did my forensic serology, meaning taking my blood.
Mm-hmm.
They already knew prior to me going to trial that I wasn't even the perpetrator because my blood type was different from the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm. But because she said it was him.
But because she said it was me, they ignored the scientific evidence and went with her statement because that was the only way they could get a conviction, along with other things that took place. I was convicted based on testimony that was inaccurate and known to the prosecution to be false. That's a violation of the ABA standard because they ain't talking to, you know, they're not talking to no average individual because I took the time to educate myself very thoroughly, especially about my case. The errors that they made were what they call blatant errors. Blatant errors in constitutional language, meaning that the case has to be reversed. But what they did, they wrote the errors off as harmless errors. Even if you write them off as harmless errors, in a cumulative sense, they all amounted to me being in prison for something that I didn't do.
What type of schooling did you have growing up? Did you graduate high school?
I went to the 10th grade, and that was it. After that, I stopped going to school.
Did you ever get a GED?
Yes, I got my GED. Matter of fact, I think I'm the only person on planet Earth that got 2 GEDs.
What you mean?
I got my first GED in 1973 while incarcerated. Mm. I was incarcerated at that time, but back in Baltimore, Maryland. In 2008, I got my second GED in Colorado in Burlington while I was incarcerated.
Which one was easier?
I think the one I received first was easier because it's difficult when you get older. Studying when you're young, I think it's more advantageous than studying after you have reached a certain age, you've gotten old. And the reason why I think it's more complex because over your young years, taking in information, studying, it was easier, but it became more complex after a person get older because now when you get older, you got different habits. Habits that I had when I was young, I don't necessarily have them today, or I don't feel that I have that quality, mature time to dedicate to particular things like I did when I was younger. So to answer your question, to get the GED this time around, where it required me studying as an elder person, is the reason why it was kind of hard.
And why did you have to go get it a second time if you already had it the first? It was no record?
Yeah, because the people here in Colorado at that time were saying, well, we contacted the Board of Education, Department of Education, and they said they don't have no records of it. They don't know if Social Security number is different and all. But anyway, they eventually found it because I had a copy of it at my mother's house. Before that became established, they was, you know, the facility here with DOC was saying, okay, well, you have to get a GED. We were told that you don't have one in Baltimore. And because of that, you have to get a GED. So that's why I had to take it a second time and I received it. But it's all good. Now I got two of them.
Now, you know, 28 years in prison is a long time. What did you do to maintain your sanity or just, you know, for you to, what did you do?
Oh, man, you know, when you're doing time, you got to roll with whatever is available. And a lot of times it was just me making decisions based on what I was confronted with and me knowing how this thing that I'm confronted with, how it's going to impact me. Mm-hmm. And because I saw the possibility the impact could be gravely negative, I had to make decisions, rash decisions, quick decisions. Mo, what you gonna do? It would be no different than if somebody ran up behind you and started choking you. Your natural response is you're gonna react.
Mm-hmm.
How you gonna react, you really don't know at that time, but you do know you're gonna react because nature, based on the circumstances and the event itself, is what's gonna compel you to act. So that's what I did. Every time a situation approached me, I looked at it from a common sense point of view, and I said to myself, what am I going to do with this issue in front of me?
We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsor. I am so excited about our new sponsor, Away. They're a company that makes pretty much the best and the most convenient luggage I've ever used.
What makes it so great, Brooke?
Well, it feels like more than just a suitcase. It's like a durable, sleek, mini closet that keeps my things organized, charges my phone and tablet, and it's lightweight so I can take it everywhere, even up the stairs with no problems.
That does sound pretty good, so it was probably expensive, right?
When I first saw it, I thought it was going to be expensive too because the materials are so high quality. But when you buy from Away, you cut out the middleman, so you get a great suitcase at a much lower price compared to other brands because there's no middleman.
Okay, I think I'm sold. Is there anything else I should know about it?
Well, it has four sizes. The carry-on, the bigger carry-on, the medium, or the large. Both carry-on sizes can charge all cell phones, tablets, e-readers, and anything else that's powered by USB. Plus, you get a 100-day free trial, so you can use it just like you would normally use a suitcase for 100 days. And if you don't like it, you can get a full refund, no questions asked.
Okay, so how do I get my Away suitcase? Do we have one of those promo codes?
Of course. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/actual and use promo code ACTUAL during checkout. One more time, that's $20 off a suitcase. Visit awaytravel.com/actual and use promo code ACTUAL during checkout. Got it?
Okay, I got it. Visit awaytravel.com/actual and use promo code ACTUAL.
How did prison affect you now?
How does it affect me now? I don't think about prison, but that there are some things concerning how I respond and act here in society that being in prison for 28 years and 5 months, it conditioned me. It programmed me because I kept going through the cycle over and over. You know what the cycle is about.
Definitely.
Yeah, they program you in the penitentiary. They have you go through a routine. It's a routine program. Up, go to bed, lock in, up, go to bed, take a shower, courtyard, back in the building. See, all that's programming. Once the human mind becomes conditioned to that, it becomes like almost first nature, although it's not. It becomes almost first nature to respond to it because this is the information. It's just like putting a floppy disk in a computer. You know, if you don't put it in there, it ain't too much you could really do. You can't gain access to information, et cetera, and files, et cetera. And the same thing with human beings. So I had to look at my situation, and because prison wasn't a new experience to me, I had to look at what has the potential to turn me into a madman or keep me civilized. And because my desire was to be civilized, because to be uncivilized, I was going to be detrimental not only to me. In a prison environment, I was going to be detrimental to other people as well, because being in there for something that a person have facts, proof, belief, et cetera, that they didn't commit. You know, sometimes we get pushed into corners and areas that bring out misery, anguish, frustration, all of these things. So now, with that reality also being a factor, individuals, I know with myself, I had to look at, Mo, do you spiral down or do you spiral up? Because depending on your choice, it's going to depend also on your level of comfort, your level of sanity, your level of sound judgment, a whole host of meaningful things that I was taking a look at. And I said, well, if I incorporate these practices here, as well as beliefs, I will maintain my sanity.
I want to make sure I get this right. I read somewhere that you were able to raise funds from other inmate DNA testing. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I was in Lyman Correctional Facility at that time. And I just took the initiative because of my innocence. And I didn't have anything to hide. Everybody that I came in contact with as far as inmate, I was telling them about my story. So I said, man, I need $1,000 to have DNA tests done. And so the guys that I spoke to, because they knew me, mm-hmm. and I never altered or changed my story from the time they met me to right now. Because mm-hmm. the truth don't need no support, because the truth is what it is. So I told the truth from the beginning all the way until November, even though they didn't give me the opportunity. I mean, I could have, but I didn't, only at the advice of my counsel for various reasons. They said, well, they'll bring up your past record. But I was at a point when you're innocent. Man, I don't care nothing about them bringing up my past record. My past record ain't got nothing to do with what I'm currently in jail for.
Nothing.
Yeah, they playing games. But see, I'm hip to the games that they playing. And these games are universal. They're all the way across the board. In every state, they play the same game. They have to, because if they wasn't, you wouldn't have all these innocent people in prison.
I also read that after those funds were raised, that the evidence was discarded. Is that true?
It was destroyed. It wasn't discarded. It was destroyed. Okay. But in the way that they are claiming that the evidence was destroyed, it wasn't like it was discarded, like somebody cut it up.
Mm-hmm.
See, in the way that they use in the word, the evidence was destroyed, it was put in a trash basket. Well, trash bags. And then after it was put in the trash bag, I was told, as well as the court was told, that it was put outside in an alley.
In the alley?
With garbage. It was put outside in the alley with other garbage to be picked up. Now, what kind of control is that when we talking about something that is so relevant to guilt or either innocence? But they had to go through that process because this is my suspicion. Them knowing that I was innocent, the guilty parties that knew that I was innocent, they had to conclude. I mean, this is based on common sense. They had to conclude, damn, we don't have the right man in prison. We know we don't have the right man because the blood type is different. So if we're going to go forward with this prosecution, we're going to have to get rid of this evidence that now says that he's innocent, or have always been saying that he's innocent. Now we have to get rid of anything that points to his innocence, and now we have to manufacture and create a setting that brings about a false guilt, because that's what they created. When they destroyed that evidence, now they was in a position to bring about a false guilt. They could make up a guilt. You can't make up a guilt when evidence is round the talented, undisputably.
How did you get a new trial, and how did that come about?
I got a new trial because the very thing, when I went to trial, see, like I said, I was convicted on testimony. I wasn't convicted on physical evidence, because had they went on the physical evidence, I would have been found not guilty, because, like I said, the semen found in the girl came from an O blood type. I'm B.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't want to address the direct evidence that directly points to who the perpetrator or the culprit is. So I was convicted off of testimony. It was years later that I went pro se and started teaching myself the law. And I said, man, I can't be dealing with her statement, because her statement is fraudulent. It's perjured. It's a lie. I got to look where the facts undisputably lies. I said, now they charged me with sexual assault, meaning that I had to make some kind of physical contact with this woman to even charge me with sexual assault. I have to have engaged in some kind of behavior that alludes that a sexual act did take place. The prosecution case was, he did that. He did that. You know, statements. But there was no records and no facts to support sexual intercourse, which was an argument made by the prosecution. My attorney at that time did not challenge the case properly. So what I did, I went back and challenged it. I said to the Court of Appeals, I said, I would like to have DNA tests done on the physical evidence that was seized from the crime scene, such as the sheets, the victim's underwear, a towel that the perpetrator was supposed to wipe herself off on that I found out. She, the victim, must be told them that. So it just don't seem right when you look at everything. Here it is, a woman saying she was sexually assaulted. It was a towel used. Now, how did the victim get to see this person wiping herself off unless she was there observing it? You would have to look at a whole lot of other things involved in my case to see the point that I'm about to make, why the whole case didn't even add up. So what I did, the only way I could successfully attack this case and just tear it apart was to go to the fabricated foundation that they was resting their whole case on, which was testimony. Okay, she said I raped her. Well, let's look at the scientific evidence. That's what I wanted to do. And so that became my focus. The Court of Appeals came back and said, Moses is raising a valid claim, and therefore, if the evidence is still available, he's entitled to test that evidence. When the Court of Appeals rendered their ruling, at that time, the money for the DNA test was already in what they call an escrow account. Mm-hmm. And we were waiting for the evidence. So with the evidence, the money to cover the testing, all would have been shipped at the same time. That never happened because the evidence eventually was destroyed. After the evidence was destroyed, there was an evidentiary hearing where I raised new issues about the destruction of the evidence. The court came back and ruled against me. I continued to litigate. It wasn't until 2012, miraculously, in 2012, the actual culprit, the person who committed the crime, wrote me a letter from another prison, shocked the hell out of me, and said, I don't know who is representing you, but notify your attorney, tell him it's time. what was done in 1987 in the dark must now come to the light. So he confessed in a letter. So what I did, I don't know how he got my name, address, or the prison I was in, but it, he got it, and he sent me the letter. So what I did, I contacted my lawyer, sent the letter to my lawyer. That's how I end up getting a new trial.
Okay.
Yeah, but I got a new trial because he came forth and confessed to the crime. Otherwise, man, I would still be in prison fighting this case because those who didn't want the truth to come out, they had did everything to make sure the truth don't come out. And to seal that deal was to destroy the evidence.
So he was someone that had put you there, but also was helping you get out. Like, that must have been one big conflicting feeling.
Yeah, it was a conflicting feeling. You know, I had questions of my own that I wanted to put forth to the individual who was responsible. One of my questions was, okay, why this long? But then I got to the point, I said, man, I'm not going to ask that man why it took this long because I don't know what happened in his life that caused it to take this long. See, we could, as human beings, I'm just talking on common sense level. You know, things could happen. You could have intentions right now. I could have intentions of walking out my door to go down the street. But by the time I walk out my door, somebody could hit me in my eye, and that changes my whole focus. Instead of going down the street, now I'm probably out here wrestling and banging with somebody because they hit me in my eye. So what I'm basically saying is things, you can have good intentions about going forward, but other things that we know nothing about may raise head at that time and cause us to veer off.
We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsor.
Hey, I love SeatGeek. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone. It's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and with just a few taps, I can instantly find seats. I actually just used SeatGeek to buy some concert tickets to the opera, and I've never been to the opera, but I'm looking forward to it, and thanks to SeatGeek.
SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. SeatGeek saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. They also help you get the most out of your money because they grade every ticket based on value. That means you can immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget.
And every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater.
Best of all, our listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code ACTUAL today. That's promo code ACTUAL for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase.
Life takes.
What was freedom? What was freedom like for you? When you, the day you was released, what was that like for you?
Well, I want to clear something up. What was release about? Release, being released was it was very exhilarating. It was a moment that I had yearned for a long time, but when it comes to freedom, what I wanted to do, I wanted to just speak briefly about freedom versus release. You know, just because you release don't mean that you are free. In fact, I think that the word freedom is kind of like misdefined, especially when it comes to situations like this that we're discussing. You know, It could be freedom after long years of incarceration. Some people could define it as that. I'm not going to define it as freedom. I'm going to define it as being in a state wherefore I am released from a situation that was illegal, unconstitutional. You see my point? I'm trying to show you that I got released. But being released cannot be compared in the same category with freedom. See, because even though I've been released from prison, still not free. If you're feeling what I'm saying.
No, I feel what you're saying.
Yeah. So I don't want to get that misconstrued. You know, we don't want to misconstrue freedom with liberty. Liberty is a state of condition. So I was released in the terms of liberty because it was a condition allowing me now to enter into a society condition. State of liberty, not freedom. Freedom is something totally different. When you hear about this country and they talking about the freedom of this country, you know, and what it was founded on, it was founded on the principle of freedom. See, we got to know what that really means. So I just wanted to correct you right there. Just a brief. Okay. So they're misconstruing with those words.
No, I totally get what you're saying, you know, between you was released. I get it. How's your adjustment been to not being locked up?
Oh, man, it's a struggle every day. You know yourself. You said you was locked up 7 years, right?
No, 22.
I think you said 22.
I was locked up from 17. Wow. Yeah, from 17 to 39 for 22 years.
Oh, so you know exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying.
It's some things, man, that you become programmed and conditioned to while in prison, that those things enter into society with you. You know, I have some habits that I adopted while I was in prison that I see now. You know, it's a number of things out here in society that my mind, because of being programmed, my mind and my memory goes right back to the penitentiary setting. This TV show. So we still adjusting, still making adjustment. Although we may be making it a lot more better than others, we may be facilitating ourselves through the channel we take, making it better for you all. You as an individual, me as an individual, to have a greater chance of survival, opposed to some people who may have been in prison for 22 years and they come out and they totally a nutcase. I thank the experience that I went through, because it was the experience that I went through that allowed me to maintain as much of my sanity as I have today. I'm not sitting here saying that Moses Eel is all 100% sane, but I'm a long ways from being crazy.
Yeah, that's funny. I can relate. Yeah, what are you doing now?
I ain't gonna lie to you. I'm not trying to work. In other words, I'm 61 years old. I'm not trying to get out here be doing no heavy lifting, because my health won't tolerate it. You know, prison, believe me, the average individual that stays in prison for the length of time that you've been in there, 22 years, and me, 28, and others longer. One thing I recognize and I've identified, the majority of those individuals coming out of prison after a long period of time, they're going to have health problems. They're going to have back problems, knee problems, neck problems. And I found that out because of how we are conditioned to make somewhat of a suitable life out of the uncomfortable material that they give us in prison, such as, I don't know how the pillars was in the facility where you were at, but the pillars that they hand out here in Colorado, man, them things hard as a brick.
They hard. You got to exercise on concrete, run, jog on concrete. That's bad for your knee. So it's a lot of stuff.
And
yeah.
They don't.
And them pillars are definitely hard.
And the mattresses. Whew. The problems I'm having right now is back problems, knee problems, the problems I never had in my life until after during this 28 years, so I know directly where my problem is coming from, health-wise.
You know, you said that you're not all the way insane. How does that affect your relationship with others, you know? Because I know me, I have a slight case of PTSD. Yeah, I'm not all the way. I'm not saying I'm just dumb or I'm just the smartest or I'm not totally crazy. But, you know, you got issues from prison.
Yeah, you got issues from prison. You bring them from prison. It's not that you asked for them. They gave them to you. They see, and one of the things, should you go forward with a civil suit later on, you should incorporate those things in your lawsuit because it makes your lawsuit stronger because it is something that you went through. And that's part of your injury that you suffered due to a wrongful conviction, psychological injury, because it's a reality. Even though you're still holding down a job now, but you know that there are things about your personality and your character that has been altered due to the number of years that you was in prison for something that you didn't do. It's connected.
Yeah, that's what PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD.
Man, I go through some things, and it's due to post, you know, after the conviction. But if it's after the conviction, now we got to look at, okay, well, if you are speaking about it after the conviction, then where's the origin? I know my origin because I didn't have no neck problems, no knee problems, no back problems when I was in society over 30 years ago. However, because I wanted to be a balanced person both physically and mentally while I was in prison, I had to engage myself in making sure that I'm healthy physically. I worked out, I jogged. I did all those things. I tried to eat the best I could with what was being offered to the inmates, which once again, also the way they sell you food from canteen creates a lot of problems that eventually creates a lot of bad, it creates health problems later on, I'll put it that way, based on the contents of the food and the preservatives in the food that they sell inmates. Food that they sell inmates, 9 times out of 10, most of the food that you buy while you're incarcerated is either going to be a contribution to high blood pressure or sugar diabetes. It's going to be high blood pressure or sugar diabetes. It's going to be one of them too, because that's the way they feed you in there. That's what the prison allows the inmate to have the most access when it comes to eating. Junk food. Food with high concentration of salt, sodium, sweets. These things, eventually after a long period of time, create health problems. So when the inmate come out, like you and me, yeah, we coming out with a big old bag. We coming out with a big old bag of luggage. Prison luggage that say, you know, they don't want, those problems didn't start here. He must have had them problems before he came to prison. No. These problems started here. And there's documentation that shows that. Because this is where I first started making the complaint. If we go to the free society, we're going to have to go to hospitals and places like that. If you go research those places, you ain't going to find no complaints ever made, like the complaints being made here while I'm incarcerated.
If someone else found themselves in that position where they have been wrongly incarcerated or wrongly accused, what advice would you give them?
Me, myself, my advice would be never to give up proving or going forward to prove and show your innocence. That's the advice I would give up because and this is just being real. The system, when you talk about a system comprised of people like lawyers, district attorneys, judges, investigators, et cetera, you're talking about people that's educated. People that's educated, when they take on these positions they make, I mean, very critical, serious decisions about individuals' life. So, looking back at the point you made about what kind of advice, see, I would encourage the person to go forward and challenge that conviction because that's all that individual have left. Some people lose hope because of what they go through. Some lose hope and say, man, I ain't even gonna fight it no more. Why? Because the system discouraged them from fighting the case. You can be discouraged by somebody constantly denying you. You can file a motion and you know your motion is on point, and the court will come back and say, denied.
That's definitely discouraging too.
That's discouraging, but it's by design. They don't say it. They don't say it, but it's by design because it's the now force an inmate to abandon even trying to litigate or prove his innocence because there are so many things that could come out of this here if it goes contrary to the way things is designed. You know, the legal system, we have a beautiful legal system here in the United States, one of the best in the world. But what makes this system so flawed? It's not the system, it's the people working in the system. That's what causes the system to appear flawed. It's just like a car. You sitting in the car, you driving. The car is not dangerous when nobody is occupying the car. The car is not moving. But let somebody get in the car drunk or under the influence. Or under the influence just being mad. He's outraged. She's outraged in their mind. Then the car becomes a weapon. The same thing with the system. The system has become a weapon for the district attorney. Sometimes it has become a weapon for the judge, depending on what kind of benefits is available. Mistakes, when they happen by intelligent people, you got to ask yourself, why did it happen? By intelligent people. Because if a man is in going to court or going to a courtroom to be tried for a case that he did not commit, and these are professional, educated people that's trying this case. And for them to know that that man is innocent and still try that case, see, once again, it's not the system, it's the people who being employed by the system look at a situation and say, you know what? I can do this, I can do that. And another thing, you know, these are things that I found out. You know, district attorneys, every time a district attorney win a case, they get points and scores for that. That helps their career, you know, for them later on to even run for certain offices and all that. So these points that they eventually gather, that don't mean that in the conviction that they received those points for, that the conviction itself was valid.
Right, I agree. They're after a conviction, not justice.
And see, the law itself states that a district attorney should not be in... The district attorney should not make a decision strictly and solely on the fact that he or she wants to convict, but to see that justice is done. That's what case law says. That's what it says, but that's not the real reality.
I've never been wrongly convicted. I can empathize with your story, but I can't imagine it. Like, I can't put myself in that situation. What do you think people like me, people who have never been through what you've been through, can do to help?
What you're doing now, that's part of it. But to help, to effectively help, is to come up with new ideas, like this podcast thing. Another way to help is starting programs that target addressing these particular problems directly, exclusively. You know, if a man makes a claim that he's innocent, that is what everybody involved should pursue. Pursue that course. Pursue, and in fact, I've heard and I've read that should be the focus of any attorney when they first take on a case. Take on the case and look at the case as if your client is innocent, even if they are guilty.
Absolutely.
Because it brings more clarity into the case, or it allows the attorney now to see things a little bit more clearer. But I think that, to answer your question, I think to be involved in programs that gets the message out, that talks about these issues, I think that's one of the ways individuals like yourself can be helpful. It's going to take individuals like yourself, and it's going to take organizational support. It's also going to take financial support, because when you look at what's going on around what's going on, such as wrongful convictions, you got people that have occupations. With these occupations comes along paychecks, you know, experts, they come to court. They say, well, we'll come to court, but, you know, we have to get paid and things like that. So it's going to take finance. It's going to take sincere people. And it's going to take an organization or a group of organizations that's going to be committed. But it's going to take fresh new minds. It's really going to take fresh new minds that haven't been contaminated by old practices. Because these old practices, they were good for the people who came up with those ideas. Well, let's put these in place, and if these things is in place, then everything will go smoothly. I don't know what they were thinking about. Maybe they were just thinking about their personal career and that alone. Maybe their personal career and family and trips around the world, kids' education. You know, they take in a lot of data to convince themselves, I guess, in the end, well, I made the right decision, irregardless. But right now, it's all about my career, my family, what I want my children to. It's a host of things, you know? But it would be good to have more concerned, genuine people like yourself with a program that has teeth, I think, along with resources, committed people, programs, and resources. I think those three things combined, they'll get the job done.
So did it sound to you like he was convicted by a nightmare? That's what I took away from me, and it's so unbelievable.
Yeah, that was real bizarre. A nightmare. That was crazy.
Until next time, thank you so much for listening.
Visit our website, actualinpod.com, for pictures, transcripts, more information about guests, and a calendar of upcoming episodes. Our website guru is Sean Cole, and our VIP of transcripts is Christina Judge. Our well-read and well-connected social media superstar is Cameron Taylor. And our volunteer of all trades is Casey Weber. Original music, scoring, and podcast production is done by musical genius Blake Maples. You can see and hear more of his work at blakemaples.com. Actual Innocence is hosted by DeMarco Carpenter and Brooke Giddings. You can hang out with us on Facebook in the group called Official Actual Innocence and Convicted Discussion Group. Just ask to join and we'll let you in. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.